light, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. There's a Buddhist story of an old farmer who had worked his crops for many years. One day, his horse ran away, and upon hearing the news, his neighbor came to visit. "Such bad luck," they said sympathetically. "Maybe," said the farmer. The next morning, the horse returned, bringing three other wild horses with him. "How wonderful," the neighbors exclaimed. "Maybe," said the man. The following day, his son tried to ride one of the untamed horses, was thrown, and broke his leg. The neighbors again came to offer their sympathy on his misfortune. "Maybe," answered the farmer. The day after, military officials came to the village to draft young men into the army, but seeing that the son's leg was broken, they passed him by, and the neighbors congratulated the farmer on how well things had turned out. "Maybe," said the farmer. "You just never know, do you? In the past few weeks, I have been haunted by people telling me how important it is to recognize how little we know, how little we understand. These are wise people, prophets, some journalists, seekers, ordinary folk like you and me. And my reaction has invariably been the same. Wait, I say, wait, I thought our goal was to understand and to know and to gain some knowledge and live according to principles and faith, to chart our interpretation of events and ideas and proceed from there. The first person who emphasized the importance of realizing how little we know was Robert Fleming, who was talking to people about the volunteers who come to visit his orphanage in Uganda, Maileka House. "You have to realize," he said, "that you don't know anything. We are really weird people to the people of Uganda. We are really weird. And coming to Entebbe, you know nothing. You know nothing at all. And only when you understand that can you be open to the children." So what was planted in my brain was the mystical importance of not knowing, of not being ready to judge or view a person or a situation through any previously held understanding or preformed lens. This is very difficult and unnerving, because to suspend what we believe to be true makes us very vulnerable. We protect ourselves with our beliefs, whether they are political or religious or moral or spiritual. They are, in a sense, our armor, our shield against unknown events, circumstances, or people that we might encounter. It gives us a way to interpret the world, a language and framework within which to make sense of our lives and the context, the environment, the community, the church, the country in which we live. So if we enter into a new school or a new work environment or attend a gathering where we know few people or just venture forth into any unknown situation, it's a lot safer to do so with a preconceived notion of what might await us. We use our minds to protect our hearts, figuring out what likely lies ahead and how we might best deal with it. To adopt, on the other hand, a stance of unknowing, to be open to whatever, whomever we might encounter, is extremely risky. What the Buddhist farmer is saying essentially is, you never know. His friends, on the other hand, place events within tidy boxes of interpretation, adopting a dualistic view. The turn of events was good, or the turn of events was bad. You have been lucky, or you have been unlucky. You have to think that this required quite a bit of mental gymnastics on their part, trying to reorder and reinterpret the circumstances within this dualistic framework. And as things changed and previously held assertions proved false, the farmer's friends scurried to shift their interpretation to affirm their own view and to maintain their armor and their shield. We see this happening all the time. As parents, we are forever trying to fortify our position of authority and wisdom as our children grow up and cleverly discern the holes in our armor. People in positions of power are experts in this way of being, some more than others. When threatened, they don more chainmail, they close the ranks, and they build walls. But they aren't alone. To some extent, this is our way of being, and I would suggest one of our greatest barriers to God. This past week, I've been reading a challenging and very provoking book written in the latter half of the 14th century by an English mystic whose name we do not know. It is called The Cloud of Unknowing, and you can guess from the title what it might be about. I'll risk doing it a disservice and just explain briefly its thesis. The thesis is this, that by surrendering one's ego and deliberate consideration of, for instance, who God might be and what is required of us, an intellectual and rational appraisal of what is right and what is wrong, by suspending what we believe we know to be true, removing our armor and opening the gates of our hearts, we just might see God. Only when we enter the cloud of unknowing can we find a more intimate union with God. But as my 5-year-old granddaughters would say, here's the deal. You don't just let go your intellectual armor and through some measure of intention suspend your tendency to prejudge whatever or whomever you might encounter. We must approach the cloud of unknowing in love. Just love. That's all. And it is everything. Because if you think you will find God in whatever form or sense or feeling, then of course you will enter that space in love. Imagine a sign by the side of the road that says, God ahead, 1 mile. My heart would soar and I'd hit the accelerator. This is a real spiritual practice requiring prayer and contemplation, but it isn't confined to moments of intentional devotion. As with any prayer or spiritual practice, the benefits start to extend far beyond the actual moments of focus. The effects permeate through one's days and nights. Consciously, intentionally letting go of one's shields and assumptions, regrets and fears, and expecting to find God before you is a radical way of living, a vulnerable one, to be sure, but as filled with redemption as we are ever apt to know in this life. And right about now, you're wondering how in heaven's name I got from Joseph and his brothers to the cloud of unknowing. And you are not alone. There were times this week when all I could do was shake my head at the path I seemed to be traveling. But I trusted that God was laying cookie crumbs down in the forest for my Gretel self. At the end of the great story of Joseph and his brothers, the duplicitous siblings seeking to deceive Joseph yet again by suggesting that their father's dying wish was that he forgive their previous deceptions, they are starving and they are in need of the plenteous stores of food that Joseph controls. So when they come to Joseph and present this falsehood, this lie, we assume, what does Joseph do? He weeps. Not understanding what his tears may foretell, forgiveness or anger, the brothers decide they have to raise the ante and tell him that they will be his slaves, to which he replies, as so many biblical prophets have before him, "Do not be afraid." And then he asks them a kind of rhetorical question. "Do I act for God? Don't you see you planned evil against me, but God used those same plans for good? Easy now. You have nothing to fear. I will take care of you and your little ones." Do you hear an echo here of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection? "You intended it for evil, but God has turned it to good." If you ask me, Joseph is sounding a lot like God. Clearly, what overwhelmed Joseph was love, pure and simple, to the point that all that had occurred before simply melted away. He let go all that had transpired in the past. All the evil intended and the pain felt, it simply vanished, and what lay before him was, in some sense, a cloud of unknowing that he trusted was filled with reunion for them all with God and with love. This is what we are invited to consider as we approach our own tomorrows, that God is there within a cloud of love. Can you unfasten your intellectual armor, suspend what you know to be true, suspend even your grudges and your misdeeds, your hurts and resentments, your fears and worries, to walk into the cloud of unknowing and trust that God will take care of you and your little ones? Can you entertain the crazy notion that maybe all will be well? That maybe what you'd thought was a disaster might be transformed into something good after all? Can you walk into work on Monday being open to what might happen? Can you greet the week ahead as a new beginning where love is waiting to be released even through pain and hardship? Last year, some friends of mine, let's call them Jim and Sarah, decided that they would hike a stretch of the Long Trail for a couple of weeks in the summer. They weren't especially seasoned hikers, but they wanted some time together away from all that barked at them at home. Theirs was a good marriage, but they'd been through an especially rocky time some years before, and it haunted them, perhaps even more than they admitted. It was especially heavy on Jim's heart and mind. He'd worked hard to forget the wounding of Sarah's affair, how it was discovered, how it played out, how it finally ended in a drawn-out death that tortured them all. They'd been in counseling and felt as they headed into their hike that they were in a good, solid place. But Jim would tell me later that before they set out, he could still taste the fetid remains of that traumatic time. He'd struggled with forgiveness. He tried to put it all behind him, but he said that honestly, he didn't know what forgiveness would look like. So that bright June morning, with their packs on their backs, they started walking. But they hadn't gone for more than half a mile when Sarah tripped on a root, fell, and hit her head on the rock. Within seconds, she was having a convulsion. And as Jim frantically dialed 911, he watched her writhe and seize. The 911 operator coached him through the appropriate actions, and finally, the convulsion stopped. But then the scary part began, because as often happens after a seizure, Sarah lapsed into a deep and almost comatose sleep. According to Jim, she turned pale, and her breathing was barely apparent. He thought she was dying. In that nanosecond, he says that everything in the past disappeared. It vanished. All he knew was gone. It wasn't in the least important anymore what she had done, whom she had loved, how she had lied. What mattered was his love for Sarah and his desire to be with her for the rest of his life. He calls it grace, pure and simple, an inflooding of God so powerful that nothing but love mattered anymore. As Joseph had, Jim wept. And in that moment when he believed his worst fears were happening right before him, he and Sarah and their life together were redeemed, turned to the good by the grace of God. Maybe our unknowing, our letting go of tightly held defenses and past wrongs, and understanding and walking into God's cloud of love, no matter how dim or unknown it is, will be our salvation. Maybe, with God's grace, may it be. Grace and peace.